This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
My father firmly and wholeheartedly believed he had been called by God to spread the good news of salvation to the poor heathen.
It was just part of the way he lived. He didn't think about it. I'd say that's what we did.
You know, that wind, you know, just taking your face off.
Before they died and spent eternity writhing in everlasting fire.
I can remember my grandfather saying, "Oh, don't worry about it. We'll open all the doors and windows and we'll roll up in rugs and we'll be fine."
And because this was true belief, there was a very strong urgency to the mission.
And from our studio in Sebastopol, California, where we spread the good news weekly, the ecumenical and nonpartisan gospels of human reality, this is indeed Hitchhiking Off the Map, and this is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller, and not many programs give you two hosts.
Yeah. Actually, we could be the next Car Talk if we could just tell you how to fix something.
No.
How about a national call-in show on bookkeeping? Some great bookkeeping jokes.
No.
Elizabeth is a wonderful bookkeeper. She really is.
Well, this is a show about journeys, and we have two stories today from our archives.
About every month or so, we're going to be going back and visiting some of these. And a reminder that you can hear our past shows anytime on our website, www.independenteye.org.
And today's shows are about, what, alien territory?
What is alien territory? It could be a country or a state of mind. I guess it's where you can't really know what's around the corner.
Our friend Steve. We caught up with him in western New York State on a camping trip. He's an actor, and to make a living, he does stuff with computers and graphics. But for the first 14 years of his life, he was growing up in the remote mountain areas of the Philippines. So we asked him, what was that like?
It was splendid. It was absolutely splendid. I was always very aware of being a special child in a special family, because the sort of status that is accorded to white folk in general and missionaries in particular, we were in many instances the first white folk that had come down the road. Not only was my father bringing the good news of salvation, but there's a certain aura to being an American in a third world country. My mother was 6 months pregnant with me when she went to the Philippines the first time. And she was a young woman who already had three children under the age of five at that point and was leaving Iowa for the first time in her life to go off to this mysterious place halfway around the world to save souls for Christ. And a remarkable woman of huge strength. All of the other transitions we did were by boat, usually by freighter. And it was about a two-week journey each time, coming and going. So there was a sense that's hard to recreate now of vast distance between the two places. The last time we came back to the States, because of health considerations, it was insisted that we fly. So we flew into Tokyo and then Honolulu and then over to San Francisco, and it just seemed miraculous that within 3 days you could go from that world to this world. And now I talk to people and it's just, oh, I've got this 12-hour flight and I'm not looking forward to it, and I think, how the world has shrunk. We were given the sense from the very beginning that we were there as a family with a purpose. And my father firmly and wholeheartedly believed he had been called by God to spread the good news of salvation to the poor heathen before they died and spent eternity writhing in everlasting fire. And because this was true belief, not just some mental exercise, there was a very strong urgency to the mission, to what we were there for. We would load up this big top tent into and on top of this GMC carryall that we drove around in. and struggle up the mountains across these incredible, tiny, washed-out gravel roads that may or may not be there on any given day. And we would enlist whatever local help wanted to help, and there was always a lot, because this, you know, this is vastly entertaining. And erect this big tent and put the generator in place. It was a huge adventure as a child to be part of this, to be going in on this, into this new area and meet the tribal people. And we were just treated with such amazing love and respect, regardless of whatever the antagonism may be toward this new religion that the white man was bringing. And there was vast, vast reluctance on the part of both the pagan elders in the mountains and the Roman Catholic hierarchy in the lowlands against this this Baptist stuff. But that never affected the unending warmth and hospitality that just radiates from these people like air. We would make great friends with whoever the kids were in whatever area we were in. And we just played. We ran amok. And I never really gave any thought to the fact that we were white kids and they were brown kids. Although frequently when we first would get to a new place, our white skin would be a subject of great curiosity. So you'd be bathing in the river or showering in whatever makeshift setup was available, and there would be, you know, hundreds of pairs of eyes peering in to see if you were really white all over. Are they white everywhere? And being the only white kids in within, you know, maybe 100-mile radius up in the mountains never struck me as anything but the way the world was meant to be. When we came back in the late 60s, we spent our first year back in Des Moines, Iowa, and it was a year of some very, very intense race riots, not just in Des Moines, but across the country. I had a new Huffy bike that I'd saved up and mowed lawns and bought, and I was pedaling it across town to my uncle's house. I must have been about halfway there, and I suddenly heard some kids shouting at me, and I looked up, and here was a large gang of black kids of various ages, and they were really unhappy to see me there. And I carried my poor mangled bike home and bleeding from the nose and scraped arms and elbows. And I think that was the day I first truly arrived in what I've come to understand America to be. It's hard to conceive of who I would be if I'd grown up differently. I have a vast appreciation for what America is and a bottomless cynicism about what America is. I think it's informed very strongly by my having grown up elsewhere and having shared that former worldview of America as the shining city on the hill, and then coming back and being plunged into it just in time for a front row seat as we burn down the cities and beat each other over the head. But you know, I was given a huge, huge gift in that the world, it was round to me from the time I was born. I knew both sides of the globe. And I grew up Filipino. And when I think of eating warm balut from a street vendor or sitting down at one of the many, many, many feasts that we would be invited to each year up in the mountains where carabao were slaughtered in honor of the visitors, and drifting to sleep each night with the sound of the drums and the gongs wafting down the hillside. The amazing beauty of the South China Sea roiling in onto pure white sand beaches. And this was all just my playground. This was where I got to be. I went from a very, very small school environment into this massive structure of a year of junior high and then into a high school of 2,000 kids and just this beehive that was pressing in on all sides. And they were all speaking this language. It literally took me a year and a half to 2 years to begin to become fluent in. You know, the slang just was totally new to me. In the Philippines, the way I was being raised and the way the people I knew were raised there, education was something that was bestowed on you by the elders in order to prepare you to take your place within the tribe or within the village or within the system of the town. You never lost sight of the fact that the people you needed to model yourself after were the elders and the chiefs and the artisans and the hunters. And from a very early age on, I learned to spot these men and watch them. And that became probably the truest part of my education as a young child. And then we came back here, and there was none of that. You just took 2,000 teenagers and sort of wadded them together and moved them from room to room throughout the day and threw facts and figures at them. And the people that these kids were choosing to model themselves after weren't the elders and the hunters, the warriors, the chieftains. It was each other. It was whoever of the kids was the alpha. And then everyone else would either model after that or do the opposite, model away from it. But you're still making your choices based on this half-formed other human being. And I look at that now again and respect to raising my son and how I want to do that, because to me, learning was a vast joy, and I hate to watch my glorious little boy get lockstepped into the hideous mistake that much of our public schooling is here in America now. The tribes people of Northern Luzon are an incredible race. They're people who lived the wheel. They lived the seasons around. In every much, every bit deeply aware as they breathed and ate. These are people who taught me a lot about the strength of being women. There's a lot of logging happens up in those mountains. And I've watched commonly two very, very strong, strapping men pick up a massive log and grunt and groan under the strain of getting it up into the air. And then they would balance that log right on the crown of this woman's head. And the woman would just start up the mountain with it, balanced on her head, taking it one step at a time. And when she got to the top of that big, big mountain, two other very large, strong men would come and grab that log and get it back down on the ground. And the woman would turn around and walk down the mountain and take the next log up. It gave me an enduring sense of power, the power that is available to all of us if we're not told what we can't do. These are people of immense simplicity, and yet they took a mountainous terrain that nobody else wanted. And somewhere way back there in those millennia, one of them got the idea that you could in fact grow rice on the side of a mountain. All you had to do was carve the mountain up into terraces and figure out a way to move water. And generation after generation, over hundreds and then thousands of years, these mountains were slowly carved into terraces. And the thought that these people have lived in this place, in these tribes, for thousands of years, carrying on this masterwork of engineering, and they have done it in a way that allows life to flow through the tribe from before time was remembered, and I think they always thought onward for more time than they could foresee. so that the individual life they were living was just, you know, one more little bend in the river of this tribe's life as they carried out this incredible physical magic of transformation.
We were talking with Steve Willite, who makes his home near Washington, D.C. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Alien territory. Well, trips into alien territory are the heart of several multi-billion-dollar enterprises, the travel industry and movies. Both of those, the principle is to give you the greatest sense of adventure within the shrink wrap of total safety, whether it's the streets of Rome or the citadels of Mars.
Yeah, those first days after crossing the borders, it's getting the new money and switching over the language.
Where is the bathroom?
Where
do they put bathrooms here?
Well, yes. And how does the bathroom work? I mean, I remember the memorable one in the French campground where the light was out and it was in a country campground, and so it was basically one of the squat things, but the flusher was really enthusiastic, so you had to take a really good bead on where the door was in the total dark, and then when you got done, pull the chain and run like hell.
I always wonder, you know, is this a country where the border guards check you out or just shoot you first? Well, but if we're really going to make it big on this show, you know, I mean, we have got to offer advice on survival. I mean, investments, travel tips, recipes, something, how to live with your teenager. You need to feel that listening to this show, actually deciding to tune in and not just catch the last 10 minutes on your car radio, but that what we say, friends, what we say will keep you safe. Yes. I mean, let's be real. I mean, it's true. Did anyone who, when they created the Department of Homeland Security, did any of you really say, oh, thank you. Wow. I feel good now. I doubt it, but that's what we long for, isn't it? And so our first travel tip of the week, here it is, okay? Get lost.
Seriously. The times that you're going to really remember are the times when you go way off the map. And think about it, you're much more likely to just buy the farm by going to sleep behind the wheel on I-90 than you are to be attacked by cannibals on Route 66.
And so here's a story about another kind of territory. Watching a loved one make a journey where you can't go. From our friend Deborah Schaus, this is A Drop of Honey.
Hours before our Rosh Hashanah dinner, I sit down at the kitchen table to write checks. I think of my rabbi friend Jeff, who is spending the week visiting elderly Jews in nursing homes. The Jewish New Year is a holiday of remembering both your sins and your blessings, Jeff reminded me last night. Inside the hushed facilities, smelling of tired chrysanthemums, meatloaf baking, and the entwined odors of urine and disinfectant, he walks to the end room, closes the door to Mrs. Cohen's room behind him, and sits beside her bed. Did you bring it? She asks. He opens his backpack and takes out the shofar, the ancient instrument which sounds on the new year. Well then, let's hear it, Mrs. Cohen says. Jeff stands, takes a deep breath, and blows. The sound, loud and unmelodic as a wounded animal, twists over the intercom announcements, over the sound of Bessie in the next room crying, help me, help me, help me, over the maintenance man buffing his way down the hallway. The shofar reminds us to distinguish between the trivial and the important in life. As I sit in my kitchen and write my checks, I think of that sound. I picture the rabbi of my childhood standing on the bima in his majestic black robes, blowing the shofar, the atonal sound like a soul struggling to rise above war and soar to victory. I write one check to Women for Women. I write to help a woman in Rwanda, one with 6 children and no shelter or food. I write to help a woman in Kosovo, a family in Bosnia. I write to help myself.
I write out another check. This one also to help those who have been plunged into chaos, forced to live in an alien world. Alzheimer's research. I write to save Luann's father. I write to save my mother. I write to save myself. Molly is the first to arrive for the holiday meal. She bustles in, carrying the chicken, kugel, and brownies she cooked up today. Her husband, Frank, walks more slowly behind her. Soon afterward, my father leads my mother into the house. She has the bewildered look of an astronaut who hasn't blasted off yet somehow finds herself on the moon. I hand her a glass of Chardonnay, her favorite wine. "What is this?" she asks. She takes an experimental sip and smiles. "For Mom, most everyone is now a stranger, and most every event, from eating to getting in the car to walking into this house, demands trust." The smell of Molly's chicken wraps around us. My daughters come in. Molly lights the candles and blesses us in beautiful Hebrew. My father serves my mother, her plate full of substances she has never seen before. The candles flicker. We sip our wine. Then I slice an apple and say, "Take a piece and pour a drop of honey on it to make it a sweet new year." Ever since I was a child, I loved this part of the holiday. The ritual that isn't about sins and righteousness, but simply a reminder to choose a sweet life. Dad hands Mom her apple. She examines the slice, oozing with honey, then shrugs. She's never seen such a thing before, but she's game. She bites in to a fruit she's been eating for 80-some years, a ritual she's been doing all her life for the very first time. Last night, my brother, who lives overseas, called me. "I was finally able to cry," he told me, "because the mother I know is gone." I have cried too. I cried for my dad, who every day sees his lover, his soulmate, companion become more of a child, more of a stranger. I cried for myself, the good daughter, the cheerful problem solver. I cried because I was sad, tired, and scared. Scared that Alzheimer's would be hereditary, that this would happen to me. I pull up a chair and sit beside Mom. Most of her conversation is random phrases, remnants not even large enough for a handkerchief. I listen and remind myself this is a time to remember blessings. Soon even these syllables will be gone. Then she says, "How is your mother?" For a moment, I just look at her. I smile and take her hands. "Gosh, Mom, only you can answer that one. How are you?" "Okay," she says, and we laugh. I walk Mom out to Dad's car. "It was fun," she says. Three syllables. A complete sentence. A sentence of happiness, praise, and acknowledgement. I walk back into the kitchen. The counter is stacked with dirty dishes. There is one piece of apple alone on a black plate. I hold the empty honey bear upside down and see if I can coax out one more drop. While I wait, I glance at the newspaper. A video store owner murdered just 1 mile from me, a woman kidnapped from a mall, a family who donated money to an animal shelter and saved the lives of hundreds of strays. Every day there is war, every day there is victory. I squeeze the honey bear and wait. Squeeze again. Shake the bear. Nothing. Then One drop falls onto the apple. Once again, something to celebrate.
That was A Drop of Honey, written by Deborah Schaus, who lives in Kansas City. You can read more stories on our website, www.thecreativityconnection.com. And the reading was by Elizabeth Fuller.
And the shofar, courtesy of Jack Rubin.
And once again, a special message. We are just beginning the long process of becoming a nationally syndicated show. Northern California, speaking to America. And you can help.
If you like the show, write to us by mail or email. We need a few words from a lot of people so that we can tell stations that there really are people who really do listen to this odd sort of show.
We've had a number of wonderful responses, but we really need responses from tons of people who listen.
You can email us, i@independenteye.org.
That's E-Y-E.
Or if you don't have email, then write to the Independent Eye, 502 Pleasant Hill Road, Sebastopol, California, 95472.
You really can make a difference to the future of hitchhiking off the map, so please take a few minutes. The Independent Eye, 502 Pleasant Hill Road, Sebastopol, California, 95472, or i@independenteye.org.
Actually, one of my earliest memories in life was standing outside of this small clapboard house in Des Moines, Iowa, bundled up in one of those old snowsuit things, so tightly that you can't move, and just standing out there in absolute awe of this cold white stuff that was falling out of the sky.